overhead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed.
I'm Picasso.
I don't get it.
You just remember
you are cultured swine. What are you looking at now?
It's not a laser. It's a little light bulb that blinks.
What's with him?
Laser envy.
Look, I'm Woody. Howdy, howdy, howdy.
You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got
Okay, welcome to the 1995 SmackDown. I think we've got everyone here, so I'm going to introduce you, and I guess alphabetical order would be the best, the fairest way. So we have Nick Davis.
Today is a day for truth.
Conrado Falco.
That's me. Hello.
Lynn Lee.
Hi, everyone.
Guy Lodge.
Hello.
The Kate Winslet hater, but we'll get to that later. Kevin O'Keefe.
Thank you for having me.
And I am Nathaniel, your host. You've all read the SmackDown. So does anybody have any, like, no, when they saw it? Or were you happy with the outcome?
I was just happy that Guy had sabotaged Kate because I felt like I had sabotaged Joan, but he did it to a far worse extent, so I felt like all of the hate would be on him. And I could really avoid any punishment.
I see. Shifting the blame.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's Guy's fault then.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are t-shirts that say that. I'm just happy it was as close as it was, because I expected it to be that way, and I'm glad, like, no one ran away with it.
Yeah, I was...
me too, because it was really hard for me to actually figure out in my ratings. I kind of wanted to give half stars, and I don't know. It was really close for me, too.
Me too, as well. I wound up tying Kate Winslet and Mare Winningham, and I probably would have given, even more so now, I'm thinking that I probably would have given Mare Winningham that fifth star, so she would have won even more. But that half star thing was compelling. It was hard to choose.
I'm so glad the structure of this doesn't require us to pick our winner, because I still don't know who I would have voted for.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, actually, since you gave 3 5-star. It doesn't happen that often, because I know
you're... everybody who listens to this podcast knows I'm nothing if not charitable and constantly...
does everybody remember who... Well, I know a couple of you were too young for this Oscar ceremony, but those of us who lived through it, do you remember who you were rooting for at the time? Like, Nick, do you remember who you were rooting for back then?
Well, no, I think I was torn even then, actually. I might have been rooting for Joan Allen, but I don't really remember. I was happy there were so many great contenders.
So I was watching it, but I actually hadn't seen either Nixon or Georgia. So obviously I guess I was rooting for Winslet just because, but yeah, now that I've seen the other, I mean, I remember thinking since that time, I really wanted to see the other two because I didn't think I would have known otherwise. So.
Well, I was rooting for Kate Winslet at the time because I was like obsessed with Heavenly Creatures. When that came out, of course, which was the year before. So to me, it was like her just rewards for Heavenly Creatures. But I also loved Sense and Sensibility at the time. But Joan Allen, she was like people... it's funny, when you look back on Oscars, people don't really think of where people started. They just like think of them as having always existed. Like Nick, what you said about Kate Winslet. Like if she's always been there... you wouldn't realize what a declaration this performance was, and I think people probably think of Joan Allen that way too.
Mm.
But I had seen Joan Allen in Peggy Sue Got Married and Searching for Bobby Fischer before this, but I did not have like a connection to her at all. But I remember at the time since I was younger and not going to as many movies, I was, you know, one of those bad people who roots for people that they haven't seen. Just based on clips, and I really loved her clips from Nixon, so she was my like runner-up at the time, even though I hadn't seen the movie.
It's an honorable impulse.
Right.
I mean, I remember at the time, the only, because of kind of the weird South African release calendar, the only film I'd been able to see by the time of the ceremony was Mighty Aphrodite. So it's not as if I was rooting that hard for Mira Sorvino, but at least I kind of, when she won, I was like, oh yeah, that one. At least I know what it, you know, what it is. So that was my lifelong struggle for most of my childhood with the Oscars.
Well, why don't we start with Mira Sorvino then, and just Mighty Aphrodite in general? Like, you've already read all our thoughts, so for this podcast, we want to talk more about the films in general, and maybe a little expanding on what we had said that we couldn't fit in, because it's actually really hard to say everything you want to say in, like, 80 words.
Yep.
So, one thing that I have to point out right away is I notice virtually all of you compared Mira to other performances, which I thought was interesting because I didn't see that in the other write-ups. Like, Conrado, you mentioned, you know, the dumb blonde archetype, Marilyn Monroe, Judy Holliday. Guy asked about Lisa Kudrow.
As I always do.
Yeah.
Which I'm dying to see. Like, I need that tomorrow.
And Kevin, you had mentioned Penelope Cruz. So I was wondering, is this just a matter of that performance not living up to the hype of being an Oscar winner, or is it just that it's such an archetypal thing, like the hooker, you know, that's in so many movies?
Probably also because Woody Allen has such a kind of long register of Academy Award nominated performances, so that's kind of a canon within itself.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, his Oscar winning performances sort of easily compare themselves to each other, especially in the supporting actors category. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I mentioned Maria Elena, and I think that was just because I mentioned in my write-up, it's like you've got sort of two different types of high energy, and one feels a little bit more real, a bit more lived in, and the other feels more like a caricature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think that's what I really didn't respond to in Mira's performance, was just that it was so overbroad. I know a couple different people mentioned The Voice, and I really agreed with Lynn's suggestion that I want to see this performance done again without that voice, because I do think there's some good stuff there. It's just I couldn't even begin to engage with it because it just felt so overbroad to me.
Well, I will say, when I sent you all the rough draft of the SmackDown, once we had all things, I had forgotten to include the reader comments.
Mm-hmm.
And one I thought was fairly insightful from James, who I quoted, he said he was knocked over by her physicality, the carriage, and the voice. Sure, it's a put-on, but what else would you expect from a hooker just trying to get hers in New York? Which I thought was a really good way to defend the performance.
But she's, like, trying to get hers while she walks to the laundromat. By herself.
Okay, fair I mean, counterpoint.
I agree that comment did make me think about a lot of the physical stuff, and Guy had mentioned that also. But yeah, I also thought Lynn's comment about the voice was really great, and I read on the IMDb page that there was even some, which I'm sure never lies, that she and Woody Allen actually had a disagreement about that he wanted her to stop doing that at a certain point, and she was like, no.
Oh.
Full steam ahead.
That's interesting, because I would have assumed the other way around. I would have assumed he was the one forcing that.
Same. I never want to agree with Woody Allen, but...
Well, it kind of sounds like I was the only person on this panel who liked this movie at all. I mean, I don't think it's obviously not top drawer Woody Allen, but I got the sense that people thought that it was almost, if not bordering on, actually misogynistic. And I remember thinking, well... You know, it is a little bit condescending towards Mira's character, but the thing is, I think the joke of the movie is always on Woody's character, not her. So I guess I felt like that kind of counterbalanced it. And frankly, I think I have this love-hate thing with Woody Allen's movies, in that half the time he is really misogynistic towards some of his female characters, but then he will come out with, like, really, really nuanced and layered female characters, and so I get whiplash every time I watch his movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got whiplash on this one just from, like, my memories of it being so different than what it actually was.
Me too.
Because when it came out, I was still, like, basically in Woody's thrall, because he hadn't had, like, the constant bad movies in a row. And if you think about it, this was right after Bullets Over Broadway, which is great.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
And but watching this again, I thought it was terrible. Like, as a film. Like, I could not connect to anything in it. I thought it was, like, sloppy. Like, I didn't remember it being this bad.
I remembered it being like middle of the road, kind of pleasant Woody Allen, and I was really stunned kind of revisiting it, just how much of a chore I thought it was, and how that Greek chorus device just really grated right from the start.
I will say that 20 years ago, I thought the Greek chorus thing was pretty funny, and this time around, I was like, ugh, they really needed to cut at least half of those scenes, but yeah. so if not all of them, but yeah, well.
I didn't remember that it took her that long to get into the movie, and since it does feel like a movie that was mostly conceived around that character, I would imagine, or his relationship to that character. And if the Greek chorus is the other idea he's had, it just seems mystifying that you would spend half an hour on the Helena Bonham Carter setup without doing anything with the two prompts that seemingly induced you to write the script. And that marriage, oh my God.
Yeah, of all the kind of weirdly matched women like Woody has put himself with in movies, like, I think that is the pairing I believe the least. Like, they don't seem to be married for 1 minute in that movie. And I'm not just talking about the actors, it's the characters as well. It's like, why are those two people together?
Yeah, and I was pretty, you know, when I do the, like, statistics as we're doing this, I was surprised from my memory that, you know, she's only in 38% of the movie, and, you know, there's a lot of other stuff in that movie. But for such a short movie, it felt long.
Yeah, I watched it, like, 10 days ago, and I already can't remember anything that's not her.
Which could be one of the reasons why she was such a slam dunk, because right. If you think about it in the supporting categories, it does seem like, I always think of Renee Zellweger, just because she's so different than everything else in Cold Mountain, that I think it's just impossible not to think of her when you think of Cold Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think,
but why would you think about Cold Mountain?
I think it's interesting that in the early 90s, this whole category was having a real kind of run with broad comic performances. You know, you had like Whoopi Goldberg and Marissa Tomei and Diane Wiest and Mira Sorvino, and that so rarely seems to happen now.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
I don't want to take things into a crass Woody Allen place too hard, but so I had never seen this movie, and I've had this sort of recurring problem with his work where now, considering everything that has happened, I do have a bit of a hard time watching his stuff like this for the first time without thinking so much about his current persona, if that makes any sense. Like often I say, you know, you separate artists from work, but the themes are, he's like, this feels like a base thing to say, but he's so creepy in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to separate that from, you know, the current persona. It makes it all feel a little bit more, it's all a little bit harder to digest.
Yeah, this might have been one of his movies that would have worked better with a different male lead, which he has done more often now.
Right.
Like, substituting people for himself.
Right.
It's also weird, all the stuff about, like, him being so anti-adoption, you know, after, you know, only a few years after breaking up with Mia Farrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sort of struck a really weird note to me, that, that entire subplot.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I think, can we all agree, though, that if this is what it took Mira Sorvino, this experiment of hers, if this is what it took to get Romy and Michelle, it's fine.
Yes.
Well, I kind of wondered about that, because I, like, one of the things I do remember liking about the performance at the time, and I still, like, respect about it, even though I didn't feel like it worked out that well, was that this was such a break from type for her. I mean, she hadn't been around that long in movies, but she'd been in Whit Stillman and his show, and it seemed like in those films she's such a I don't know if cerebral is too strong, but a kind of austere sort of intellectual partner with the other scene characters. And so watching her go this far into, like, I'm going to try a totally different kind of performance and play totally dumb, even though all the publicity around her was about Harvard and East Asian studies and super smart. And then suddenly she gets stuck playing this over and over and over again. When it seemed like she conceived of it as a, you know,
a one-off.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hard to think now actually what Mira Sorvino's kind of image or legacy is, since her career just really hasn't panned out in a very legible way. It's like, who is she now?
Right.
I can't really identify her with the screen persona.
Mm-hmm.
I watched this movie called Tarantella before this podcast that she also made in 95. Has anybody seen that?
Uh-uh.
She's this daughter of a recently deceased, you know, Italian-American woman, and she's been bad by leaving the Italian-American enclave and moving to a city and getting her own job. And has to learn in her, like, small house in Long Island or wherever we were to cook bolognese and be real.
Mm-hmm.
But she's... It's definitely like a little glimpse at like the lead career she seemed like she was kind of interested in before this happened. And she's again like the sort of brunette, slightly austere intellectual.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's a little strange given, you know, that the career didn't pan out, that she didn't really like explore the East Asian stuff you're talking about either, Nick, because she did make a couple of, like, I actually saw a Japanese movie that she was in.
Mm.
And she also did that that
Replacement Killers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like she was kind of interested in being like a international star as well.
Yeah.
And then that didn't really. I don't know. It's a strange career. But she was a newbie at the time, or fairly new.
Yeah, I mean, I remember she hadn't really been that much on kind of the radar regular moviegoers before mm-hmm. this, actually.
Well, now we all feel sad.
I know, I'm sorry. That was, like, our energy petered out, so we should probably move on.
She has her Oscar, you know, so...
Uh-huh.
Sorry, wasn't there a whole thing about supporting actress Oscars' careers going to die after winning? I don't know if that's actually still true, but I remember... Then again, people said that about Marissa Tomei, and she seems to have had at least... Well, apart from now being cast as Aunt May, a little bit of fear.
she definitely endured. She definitely endured.
Vera Sorvino will get to play Aunt May after Marissa Tomei for the next reboot. She just hangs in there.
Shailene Woodley.
Emma Stone.
I'm gonna call it now. So let's move on to Kathleen Quinlan. Apollo 13 is actually the last of the movies I watched for this, and it's the one I hadn't seen in the longest time, actually. Yeah. Except for Nixon, which I had never seen, but and I watched it like super early in the morning, and I thought, oh, you know, I can sleep through this because you know, she's barely in it. And I was so involved. It's such an exciting movie.
It is. I'd forgotten how good this movie was because I hadn't seen it since it came out. I saw it originally in 95 and I remember liking it, but I haven't seen it since. And it still really works as a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, and I think one of the other commenters noted this, this is one of the few cases where I almost feel like, I don't want to say there shouldn't have been any parts with the women and family because, you know, that's important, but I did get a little impatient whenever we got to those scenes, which wasn't terribly fair to Quinlan because I actually thought she was quite good. But, you know, let's face it, all the exciting stuff was happening, you know, either in Houston or in space. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was me. I hate to say, I don't want to, like, not have a woman in this movie, but I was with you. I got really frustrated, and more than that, I feel like the movie got a little frustrated.
Yeah.
I think I probably liked the movie a good bit less than everyone else here, but I also am sort of like allergic to Ron Howard.
Uh-huh.
But it did seem like the movie really just wanted to be up there or in the control room the entire time, and sort of like would be like, I guess we have to pay attention to a woman now, and I ranked her so low because I just didn't think she brought much anything more to what was already a lame part. But I just felt like the movie sort of treated her existence with maybe not disdain, but like at least like extreme indifference.
Well, that's the thing. I was trying to think, how could the movie have made her character more interesting? And I admit I kind of drew a blank. I'm not like, again, if you do too much of that, then you take the focus away from what, you know, the movie is supposed to be about. So
right.
I didn't really see a solution to this, and I think I actually give her credit for, you know, making her noteworthy at all. So
I actually agree with that too. Like I think that there's just the right amount of her. Particularly, and I didn't remember this about the movie, that it actually takes quite a while for the adventure to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those foundational scenes is where she earned this nomination, actually. Just because her and Tom Hanks have such a great chemistry, I think. It's so unforced. And it feels like they're so comfortable, like they've been living together for years. But I did think it was interesting that that the comments about her were so opposite. Like, Nick, you said she's the best friend and peer, but not the idolater. Yeah. And then Guy said she's playing a wife, not a woman. So it did seem like people were having opposite reactions to her.
You want to take that one, Guy?
Oh. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least four of us mentioned the supporting kind of formula that so often kind of reaps nominations in this category. And I guess, you know, she's doing the job. I think it's a necessary role, and she's, you know, I don't think she's doing anything wrong. I just don't think it's a performance that needs to be nominated for an Oscar. I don't think the character needs to be drastically reformulated, but it just seems like an uninspired nomination that could have gone elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Conrada, we haven't heard from you much. I know you and Kevin were both really young when these movies came out. Had you seen any of these before?
I had only seen Sense and Sensibility before. And I liked it quite a bit. But yeah, and I liked most of these movies. The only one I didn't like was Mighty Aphrodite.
So with Apollo 13, was this something where you were like sitting there the whole time like, why was she nominated?
I mean, it does seem kind of like a kind of role that gets nominated when they love a movie and then there's a supporting performance that they want to support along with the front runner. So I wasn't surprised by that, but I definitely thought this isn't like an amazing performance or anything.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be like one of those things where you being in the right movie can be so crucial for Oscar.
Which is why
it's a little strange that Magda from Babe was not nominated.
Yeah. It's also kind of odd that, I mean, Kathleen Quinlan definitely got a coattail nomination for Apollo 13, yet it didn't exactly, you know, clean up. It kind of missed in some really crucial areas, like, you know, Ron Howard not getting that nomination, and, you know, not getting like a cinematography nomination or whatever. It sort of feels like the film wasn't a sweeper by any means, but she somehow sort of rode it anyway.
Mm-hmm. I think she was the only acting performance nominated, correct?
Ed Harris was as well.
Oh, Ed Harris. Oh, okay. I'd forgotten that. Yeah, it does kind of feel like one of those ensemble things where you want to recognize everyone, so you have to pick someone.
Yeah.
Like a SAG prize for them, you know, would have made a lot of sense. I don't remember if they won or not.
I think they did, actually.
Like,
okay.
Old awards, basically.
Yeah. Whereas when you, like, a lot of these, well, I mean, not Mighty Aphrodite, but or Georgia, but a lot of these movies have a lot of characters. So I was noticing, in Sense and Sensibility, I guess I'm hopping around now, but, you know, if you look at, like, the statistics that we post with these, Kate Winslet has a lot of screen time, but so does everyone. There are so many people crammed into the frame. Alan Rickman's in tons of it.
Yeah.
The little girl's in tons of it. The mom's in it's very much an ensemble piece, even though it's about the sisters.
That was something I really loved about Sense and Sensibility. I know Nathaniel, you always talk a lot about having as many people acting in the same frame as possible. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had that in my mind, especially in that scene where Winslet's lover, who, of course, I'm going to forget the name of the character,
Willoughby.
When Willoughby brings her back, and you've got all of those women packed into that room.
I love that scene.
And their reaction is so characteristic of each character.
Yes.
It's really great. And I sort of think if that movie was made today, we would not get that scene.
Right, yeah, which is why I'm always, like, stressing how important it is to have, like, medium and wide shots instead of just two shots or one shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The editor, Tim Squires, came to grad school to promote Crouching Tiger with Ang Lee when I was there, and he was it was before the Oscar nominations that year, and he was admitting, like, I totally want to get nominated. I'm not going to lie about that. I think it might happen. But this movie was so much easier to edit than like Sense and Sensibility, where we filmed every scene in close-ups on every character, and then wide shots, and then sister shots, and then whatever. And the audience is curious about every single person's reaction all the time. And so to include everybody or only go to one person was always such a choice at every single beat of the movie. So now when I watch it, I just think about that constantly. And he's like, and of course it's the kind of genre where nobody ever gets any credit for editing anything.
Right. Yeah. Well, didn't he also edited Brokeback Mountain, right?
He didn't. It's actually the only one, I think, of Ang Lee's movies that he didn't.
I think it was
Dylan Tickner and Geraldine Peroni.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah. But also that one wasn't nominated, so
yeah.
Ang Lee movies with editing, it's weird.
But I think it might actually have to do with this thing of how often Ang Lee does let us watch lots of people in the frame, and to a lot of viewers that means like they didn't edit, you know? And it's so not what that means, but I mean I guess I get the presumption.
Right. Well, when we were discussing Sense and Sensibility, which was such a joy to rewatch, like I hadn't seen it in a long time, and good God, that movie's fun and moving and everything. I love it. What struck me as Lynn and Guy, it seems like your two takes on it are very, very opposite, which I thought was interesting. Lynn, you were talking about her control, and then Guy, you were talking about how she had too much control.
Sorry, go ahead. No, you go.
No, I was going to say, I actually thought that was interesting because you're right. I feel like we kind of had a similar reaction. Well, we observed similar things, but we just had different reactions to it. And I guess I liked the fact, I didn't think it was over-controlled. I actually, you know, you think of Marianne as being this really headstrong, impulsive character with no control at all. And at the same time, you know, it's such a controlled performance that in a way I was like, wow, she really somehow managed to do that, like not let the character get away from her, but still, you know, make us see all the beats in a really organic way. And I don't know, this was obviously something that I didn't really consciously think about when I saw it 20 years ago, but it really struck me. And I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but it had been a while also for me, and that's what really struck me this time around. But, you know, I can kind of see, I guess if you have a different... And I actually am not as huge a fan of Kate Winslet as a lot of other people are. I think I go back and forth on her, but this is one performance that I actually think it's still probably my favorite, even though it's also her big, well, her second big breakout.
I mean, I think, despite my fairly low rating of it, I do think it is, you know, I can't deny the kind of skill and the craft and the performance, which is, it's then unusual to rate it that low, but I just think it's skill and craft in service of kind of incorrect characterization for me, which is an interesting case. And it's, so I think it's like an honorable miss of a performance, but it just doesn't gel for me.
Well, I wanted to point out, Kevin, also I loved what you said about her best moment at the ball, how extreme she played each beat, but then the beats change so much. Like, that's actually what I love about the performance in general, is just how boldly underlined all the emotions are, and yet it doesn't come across as like a crass performance.
No, not at all. She manages to imbue humanity into everything, so it doesn't feel so sharp. This is going to be a weird comparison point, but I was thinking of Keira Knightley in A Dangerous Method, that Cronenberg movie from a couple years ago. Because, like, when that movie came out, you know, the response was sort of like, oh, she's really going for it, for better or worse. I sort of think Kate Winslet does the same thing here. Like, she is really going for this role. It's just, it's in a much more understated way. So it wouldn't get that same level of, like, she's not, you know, like, gnashing her teeth like she's a junkie, but she does sort of, like I said, she does play those extremes to the hilt. It's just, she gets to play more of a human in it, and I think that's why it's more digestible for us, and why it's more, why we accept it a lot easier, is because it's, you know, she's prim and proper in addition to playing these emotions to their craziness.
Well, I thought was really interesting and unintentional, but this is what happens when you get Oscar categories together and, like, Oscar retrospectives, is seeing this and Georgia in such close proximity. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they're both, like, in addition to both being sibling dramas, they're really, like, both doing the Sense and Sensibility thing with, mm-hmm. with the two sisters.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Which I thought was so fascinating to see this all this time, and to like wonder what my disconnect was back in 1995, because I did see Georgia when it came out, and I loved Mare Winningham in it at the time, still do, think it's like an amazing performance, but really not responding at all to Jennifer Jason Leigh. Which I still, when I watch the movie, I'm like, can we go back to Mare? Which I know other people do not feel the same way about. Like, I believe Nick and Guy, you're big fans of Jennifer Jason Leigh in it. But the interesting thing to me about looking back on it is I didn't, when Sense and Sensibility came out, I didn't actually love Emma Thompson in it.
Oh, really? Oh.
And this time I was so floored by how, like, perfectly modulated that is. And, like, I don't know why could I respond to something as subtle as Mare but not Emma at the time? And now I can. Just, like, time makes a difference, I guess. I don't know.
It really does. I mean, I remember, I don't know how many people have read the book Sense and Sensibility, but when I was younger, I don't know, I guess I was more Team Eleanor in that I always found Marianne incredibly annoying just because she, you know, it's that, I sort of sympathize more with Eleanor's attempt to try to, like, you know, keep things together and observe certain proprieties. But what's funny is now I look back and I think I've just become more sympathetic to Marianne, and maybe it's because I now see her as being really, really young, whereas at the time she was basically my age. But now I'm almost seeing Eleanor and being like, oh my God, Eleanor, loosen up a little bit. Like, and yet at the same time, I'm still very sympathetic to her. And I think Emma Thompson is, you know, I still think she's amazing in the role. But it is interesting how your perspectives change over the years. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
I totally agree. Like, I mean, I've agreed with everything you've said about this whole movie. I really like, and this gets back to the conversation between Lynn and Guy, but I really liked that both of them have these moments. Like the first, like in the scene where Hugh Grant reveals that he has, you know, politely taken himself out of the bedroom that they have given him and realizes what an affront that was and how insulting that would be. Mm-hmm. And the close-up on Kate Winslet is all about her thoughtful reaction to what that means about this person, that he perceived that and immediately took care of the problem. And the close-up on Emma Thompson is like she's moved. And so it's kind of the opposite of who you're expecting to play Sense and who you're expecting to play Sensibility in a way. And I really liked that neither one of them just locks into thinking of those as total contrasts. And
right.
I think I admired about Winslet what Lynn did, that I feel like watching this movie now, you see that it's when she meets Willoughby that she totally tumbles into too much sensibility. But it's not like in the world she's only that. Like, she's incredibly smart, that character, mm-hmm. and thoughtful.
I think that's right, because I feel like in the book, and again, it's been a while since I've read the book, Marianne is just kind of like that all the time. But in the movie, you definitely... I was actually also... This ties into whether she's really a supporting actress. And actually, Nathaniel, I'm kind of interested to hear your take on that, because I know you feel strongly about this subject. But I remember thinking she really does kind of take a backseat for about the third of the movie, which is more focused on Eleanor and Edward. And then once she meets Willoughby, it's like, you know, she kind of just comes alive almost. Like, you really see her embody sensibility. And then, you know, then she has that great crash. And then it's kind of like, it's not that she retreats exactly, but I feel like the focus is back to Eleanor again. But yeah, I mean, I think what we do see of her, apart from that middle part, is, you know, a lot more layered than just her being a creature of passion all the time. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, honestly, when it was over this time, I just wanted to start it again. That's how much I enjoyed seeing it again.
Yeah.
So we should probably move on from Sense and Sensibility. But when it comes to the category thing, I do have trouble with both Georgia and Sense and Sensibility in that I understand that from my own perspective and what I've said over the years, I should be both, oh, they're both leads. But I do... maybe it's easier for me with older races before I was writing about the Oscars to go, okay, that's how they campaigned or whatever. But with Sense and Sensibility, it is such an ensemble that it's easy for me to go, okay, she's supporting, just because everyone is so crucial to it.
Yeah.
But I could see either argument.
I actually, I buy Winslet as lead a lot more easily than I buy Mayor Winningham as lead.
Hmm, okay.
With that performance, I mean, I know the movie's named after her and everything, and that's sort of the point, but the movie is not about her. The movie is about Sadie, and we, to a certain extent, see Georgia through Sadie's eyes up until the point that we don't. Mm-hmm. And I guess because it is so Sadie's story and Georgia is what she's aspiring to, basically, although mm-hmm. that may be simplifying it too much. Yeah, I do buy that more as
that's
a supporting performance. Whereas Winslet is, I mean, just down to screen time, like, she's in so much of the movie. Like, mm-hmm. I that just feels so much more lead to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a similar reaction, but I think that had everything to do with the fact that Jennifer Jason Leigh I couldn't figure out how I actually reacted to her because it was like almost too much, but I couldn't take my eyes off her the entire time she was in the movie. So that says something, and it was just like I almost had to consciously focus to Mira Winningham, and she was really good, but I was just, I don't know, I think I was weirdly fascinated. Maybe it's like the train wreck kind of thing where you can't take your eyes away from that. But
well, yeah, I worry about that sometimes. Like, I've seen the movie a few times, and like I always have the same reaction to Jennifer Jason Leigh, where I'm just like, no, go away. but I think that's why the movie works so well, because it's so incredibly tense in like every scene. And like, I loved what you wrote about their duets, because like that, I forget what the song was called, but like that number where Sadie is just like really just not, it doesn't even feel like a song anymore. She's just having so much trouble getting through it and so repetitive, and then George just sort of fades into the song to try to rescue it. Mm-hmm. And all of the incredible ripples of that emotionally, which mm-hmm. I think it's such a well-scripted movie as well.
It is.
And I think it's a little weird that it only got attention for Mayor Winningham, because it's really a strong movie in general.
On that idea... Sorry, go ahead, Lynn.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it was the first time I'd actually ever seen it, and yeah, I thought it was just really well done as a movie, not just the performances, but mm-hmm. That's all I have to say.
Well, and like, Conrado, I loved what you wrote about the elevator scene.
Because yeah,
it's
yeah.
one of the rare moments where it almost breaks her exterior, and it just like what we were talking about with control with Kate Winslet, like it's kind of like, why hasn't Mare been given a million opportunities to show this again, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, I know she still gets work, but
although you can imagine that you could admire this performance tremendously and not be like, I want to see her do that again. I want to be around Georgia Flood all the time. Like,
that's
so specific to what the film needs from her.
But, yeah, yeah.
And just ingenious. I mean, I love this movie. It's almost hard to talk about.
I noticed that Mary Winningham got a relatively low rating from the readers. So I don't know if, Nathaniel, you have something like... to comment on what they said or something? Because I'm curious about that,
well,
considering she won.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone who sends in ballots actually writes quotes, but a lot of people don't actually explain, so I don't really know why. I think, but it seemed to me, like, the few negative comments seemed to me along the lines of, you know, just too bland, which I think is... Like, I don't want to judge how anybody responds to a movie, but I think that's an inherent problem with the part, in that it can feel that way. And it's the same way with Sense and Sensibility, really, like in how I responded to Emma Thompson at first. Like, when you have these people who are way too controlled emotionally that it makes other characters crazy, it can read as bland if the movie or the actor is not completely on point.
I think especially in the early going, she seems very much to be falling into a kind of a long-suffering kind of archetype. And then as she kind of gradually sort of reveals more and more of that kind of coiled-up aggression that's inside her, I think it's a is a much more kind of complex and much more dominant character than she initially seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I just say, the comparison I made was to Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern in Wild, in that it's so crazy to me that Laura Dern would ever be nominated without Reese Witherspoon also being nominated. Just because it almost feels like there should be like a separate category for like performances together. Yeah. Like to me, they are so. One does not work without the other. And I think both performances are fantastic, but I think you need both. I think Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet, again, could also fit into that same mold. But, of course, Emma Thompson was nominated.
Right.
Jennifer Jason Leigh not being nominated is just sort of it feels absurd in retrospect.
And that brings us to the end of part one. In part two, we'll discuss more about Georgia, as well as Oliver Stone's Nixon, and a little bit more about the Oscars in general. So come back for part two.